This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, February 14, 2005. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. As President Bush asked for $80 billion for Iraq and Afghanistan, former contractors in Iraq testify about fraud and corruption. Law students in Northern California demonstrate against military recruiters on their campus. And the results of the Iraqi election are final. We'll check in with Baghdad. These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Thousands participate in massive demonstrations around Argentina, blocking roads, and marching to the Labor Ministry for better jobs and social services. Matt Goldin has more from Buenos Aires.
Members of the Piquetero movement started their mobilizations today as promised. Three main routes are blocked to the capital of Buenos Aires and in another nine provinces of the country. In the city of Buenos Aires, there will be mobilizations to Plaza de Mayo and the Labor Ministry. Unemployed workers want an increase in the quantity and value of social programs, the same since the devaluation of the Argentine peso in 2002. However, inflation for basic necessities like food has increased 75%. Unemployed workers are also demanding work for all the Argentinians and a general increase in wages for all the employed and unemployed workers in the country. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, this is Matt Goldin from Buenos Aires, Argentina.
Urging a public boycott of chocolate this Valentine's Day, one U.S. congressman wants the chocolate industry to clean up their act and end child labor. Shirley Chang reports from D.C.
Chocolate you may be buying for loved ones on Valentine's Day may be picked by child slaves, according to two U.S. congressmen, Representative Elliot Engel of New York and Senator Tom Harkin of Iowa, say that chocolates from food giants Nestle, Mars, and Hershey are likely made with cocoa picked in West African nations like the Ivory Coast. Most of the workers are young boys who work in brutal conditions and live in squalor. On June 28, 2001, the U.S. House of Representatives overwhelmingly passed an amendment proposed by Representative Engel, which set aside $250,000 for the Food and Drug Administration to create a labeling requirement on products to indicate that no child slave labor was used in the harvesting of cocoa in that product. Chocolate companies have agreed to work on eliminating abusive child labor in cocoa growing. However, last month, the chocolate companies informed the government that they would not be able to meet the deadline to create an industry-wide certification regime. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Shirley Chang.
The U.S. Senate started debating the merits of the Bush administration's hopeful and likely next Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. Darby Hickey has more.
Michael Chertoff's nomination as Secretary of Homeland Security has been supported by both Republican and Democratic senators. But Democratic Senator Carl Levin of Michigan took 2 hours on the Senate floor today to criticize the handling of Chertoff's nomination.
What deeply troubles me is that information relevant to his confirmation has been arbitrarily denied to the Senate by the Justice Department.
One whistleblower, Jesselyn Raddick, has said that under Chertoff, the Justice Department tacitly approved illegal interrogation tactics. Raddick says she was fired and slandered, and that Chertoff and others tried to cover up her reports. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Darby Hickey of the D.C. Radio Co-op.
Walmart reached a settlement with the U.S. Department of Labor for allegedly breaking child labor laws in three states. Avishai Artsy has more from New Hampshire.
The 24 alleged labor violations by Walmart took place at stores in Arkansas, Connecticut, and New Hampshire. According to the complaint, teenage workers were instructed to use hazardous equipment like paper balers and forklifts, which violates child labor laws. Walmart denies the allegations but has agreed to pay the penalty of $135,540 within 30 days and to train store managers on child labor law compliance. Critics are calling it a sweetheart deal. They say the Labor Department provides Walmart 15 days' notice before it is investigated, allowing the company to sweep violations under the rug. Victoria Lipnick, Assistant Secretary of Labor for Employment Standards, disputes that criticism. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Avishai Artsy in Nashua, New Hampshire.
For the first time since Kosovo became a United Nations protectorate 5 years ago, the Serbian head of state is visiting. Jackson Allers reports from Pristina.
Under tight security, President Boris Tadic's visit has been called a significant trust-building measure by Kosovo's head UN administrator. An estimated 100,000 Serbs still live in Kosovo. Approximately 200,000 have fled the province since the end of fighting between members of the ethnic Albanian majority and Serbian security forces in 1999. During his tour of impoverished Serbian villages, Serb President Tadic said that Kosovo's independence was unacceptable and violated international law. The international community is making moves towards granting Kosovo independence if the Albanian-dominated provisional government makes good on a set of 8 democratic standards that will assure the rule of law and the protection of Kosovo's ethnic minorities. The United Nations and NATO peacekeepers were unable to prevent ethnic riots last March, which left 19 people dead and 4,000 mostly Kosovo Serbs displaced. The first talks on Kosovo status are tentatively set for the middle part of this year. Jackson Allers for Free Speech Radio News in Pristina, Kosovo.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Today, President Bush formally requested an additional $80 billion, the majority of which would be earmarked for military operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. The request pushes the nation's budget deficit to a record high and comes as former coalition provisional authority employees in Iraq testified on Capitol Hill of rampant fraud and abuse of billions of dollars in U.S. contracts. Mitch Jezerich reports.
Amid numerous accusations of abuse and fraud of U.S. contracts in Iraq, the U.S. Congress is still likely to approve the president's new $80 billion request.
In our case, the Bush administration has not lifted a finger to recover tens of millions of dollars that our whistleblowers allege was stolen from the government.
Alan Grayson is an attorney that's heading a lawsuit charging the company known as Custer Battles for defrauding the U.S. out of $100 million in contracts. Grayson also represents several other whistleblowers who were to testify today at a Democratic policy hearing but canceled at the last minute. Grayson explains.
They faced death threats, and one of them has had a $50,000 bounty on his head since the case was filed and it became known to the defendants. The new reason is that they now fear retaliation from the Bush administration. They both are government contractors, they work for government contractors, and they are concerned that the Bush administration might cut off the flow of work to the companies that they work for.
The hearing comes just 2 weeks after an Iraqi inspector general reported that the former coalition provisional authority cannot account for almost $9 billion of Iraqi money. The report is another item in a long list of alleged monetary frauds involving U.S. forces and companies. Also testifying was journalist Don North, who served as U.S. government advisor to develop the Iraqi press. He said that the CPA's media efforts were not working towards developing a free press.
Instead of covering stories of consequence to Iraqis, like the difficulties of establishing security, the electricity problem, obtaining gasoline, we were inundated with orders to cover CPA press conferences.
Without the GOP's blessing, today's hearing was unofficial. There's been little congressional oversight of Iraqi contracts and not a single hearing on the missing $9 billion. Out of the president's new $80 billion request, $75 billion would go to the military in Iraq and Afghanistan. Several hundred million will go to tsunami relief and to the Darfur region in Sudan. Another $100 million will go to modernize Poland's military. Mitch Jezerich, Free Speech Radio News.
Final results yesterday for the recent Iraqi election show a nearly 50% victory by the Shiite Coalition, or United Iraqi Alliance. The Kurds also gained about one quarter of the vote, while Sunnis largely abstained from participating and only gained 5 seats in the assembly. Joining us to talk about the election is FSRN correspondent David Enders in Baghdad. Sunnis are seriously outnumbered in this election. What does this mean for their future?
Well, that's going to depend on how willing to reconcile the Shiites are. Even the Sunnis who did win seats are not necessarily representational Sunnis. And so it's going to depend on the Shiites to really reach out to those leaders who do hold some sway and try and bring them into the new government.
And are people speculating to what extent the Shiites will want to impose Sharia or Islamic law?
They certainly are. The widespread feeling, and this is sort of what's been mentioned by the candidates themselves, is that they're looking to implement it in personal status matters, such as marriage, divorce, and inheritance. And in those areas, the laws tend to sort of heavily be in favor of men.
And finally, regardless of which group received the most votes, what does this election mean? Are Iraqis seeing an improvement in their day-to-day activities?
Not particularly. A lot of people think the security situation here has gotten worse. Both the oil ministry and the electricity ministry say attacks on their infrastructure have steadily increased. This was a vote that was largely in favor of restoring some sort of viable Iraqi sovereignty. I think that's, in addition to the edict from Ayatollah Sistani, one of the other reasons people did actually turn out. And so now it's going to be up to the new government to actually meet them halfway on this and show some progress. And also, I think, start talking seriously about getting occupation troops out of here.
David, thank you for joining us today. David Enders is our correspondent in Iraq. He joined us today from Baghdad. A massive car bomb in Beirut killed Lebanon's foreign prime minister, Rafik al-Hariri, today, just 4 months after he resigned from his post. The explosion killed at least a dozen people and injured at least 100 more. A group calling itself Support in Jihad in Syria and Lebanon have taken responsibility for the attack on Al Jazeera television, although the claim could not be authenticated. Meanwhile, in the Philippines, three bombs exploded in various cities today, killing at least 11 people and injuring over 100. The past week has seen at least 70 people killed in a series of bombs, which the Islamic group Abu Sayyaf calls retaliation for a major military offensive against the group in the southern Philippines that recently killed 60 people. And, as FSRN correspondent Carrie Byron reports, the violence is not likely to stop anytime soon.
By Sunday evening, over 70 casualties and 16,000 refugees had been recorded after a week of what has been described as the bloodiest fighting in the Philippines in years. This latest in the decades-old skirmish with Muslim separatists was sparked after military operations on February 1st killed 4 civilians, including a mother and her 13-year-old daughter.
The government and the military is not telling the truth, you know?
Tony Leong Sun is a board member with the Moro Christian People's Alliance, a nationwide advocacy group.
They just blame the MNLF as a terrorist group who wanted to disrupt peace, you know? But they're not telling the truth that what happens first is the massacre of the people in Imbung Sulu, which happens in February 1st at 6 a.m.
The Moro Christian People's Alliance members had just returned from a Valentine's Day rally outside of the Department of National Defense, where MCPA spokesperson Kosen Naga had hoped to remind officials of the cycle of violence that the region has continued to experience.
The places where Muslims live in the south were the most poverty-stricken, most neglected, and heavily militarized. And they do not like the support of the U.S. government to the Philippine military.
That last observation has become an extremely sensitive issue in Sulu and the surrounding regions during the past week.
There is a report that U.S. soldiers were spotted in the battlefield as advisors and consultants to the Philippine military.
While the U.S. formerly maintained two major military bases in this country, that treaty was discontinued by the Philippine Senate in 1992. The Philippine Constitution now specifically disallows the active participation of any foreign military in its internal affairs. A contentious agreement continues to allow for extensive military training between U.S. and Philippine forces. However, due to public sentiment in the region, Sulu has always been off limits to those exercises. These latest reports now have many worried that the U.S. military may be taking the current violence as an opportunity to strengthen its stronghold in this, quote, second front in the war on terror. Again, Kosen Naga.
Yeah, it is increasing, and that is very bad, no? If ever a military U.S. Personnel will be killed, then the U.S. government will have a reason to send troops in Mindanao.
On Monday evening, three explosives went off around the country within minutes of one another. Shortly after two large southern Philippine towns were rocked, a third explosive went off in an upscale part of Manila. All three explosions were in heavily populated areas, killing at least 11 and wounding at least 53 more. The radical Muslim group Abu Sayyaf, who earlier this month joined forces in Sulu against the current military action, has taken responsibility for the blasts, calling it a Valentine's Day gift to Philippine President Gloria Macapagal-Arroyo. In Manila, this is Carrie Byron for Free Speech Radio News.
Over 250,000 demonstrators on both sides of the issue massed in Russian towns on Saturday to condemn or applaud social benefit reforms by President Vladimir Putin's government. In the biggest demonstration over the issue, thousands of Putin supporters marched through the center of the capital, chaperoned by armed police. It was the first major turnout in favor of the president since protests began last month in his hometown of St. Petersburg, when thousands of pensioners turned out to denounce a new law reforming social benefits. Danuta Zhafranych reports from Warsaw.
The new law, which took effect on January 1st, strips millions of the poorest Russians, pensioners, low-income families and disabled people, of rights such as free bus travel and free healthcare, replacing them with 200 to 300 rubles cash payments instead. Participants of the biggest of protests staged over the weekend, the pro-Kremlin demonstration in Moscow, like this young man, say that introduced reforms will put the system of social benefits in order.
Right now, the government is implementing reforms which we have talked about in our homes for a very long time. Reforms which so far have not been aimed at the poorest inhabitants of the villages. For the first time ever, the country is making a step towards improving the economic situation in this respect.
The issue has caused the biggest dent in Putin's popularity since he breezed through his re-election a year ago and gave communist and nationalist deputies ammunition for a parliamentary vote of no confidence for the government last week. The government survived that vote, but parliament forced an embarrassing apology for improper implementation of social benefits reforms from Prime Minister Mikhail Fratkov and secured a 30% hike in a basic state pension. Analysts, however, say that this is not the first series of protests and it may not be the last on this issue. Jadwiga Rogoza of the Center for Eastern Studies in Warsaw.
Paradoxically, one can say that the first crisis which erupted after the introduction of social reforms in January has been averted because the authorities gave up some of its decisions. For example, they introduced cheap monthly passes, convenient for many Russians. Still, there are a few issues which, in the future, may lead to social unrest again. For example, reforms of health and education systems, which are still to be introduced. Russian society reacts very emotionally to these reforms, and if the authorities try to limit or adjust them to rules of market economy, protests may be staged again.
When talking about necessary market changes in Russia, many analysts here in Poland point out the contrary direction of protest staged recently in Ukraine. They agree that protesters in Ukraine fought for democratic society, while Russian citizens still really want to keep the model of protective society prevailing in Russia so far. Since Russian authorities, fearing a loss of support, didn't show too much determination in implementing the reforms, those changes may not happen in Russia anytime soon. I'm Danuta Szafraniec, Free Speech Radio News, Warsaw.
The Democratic Party has elected former Vermont governor and Democratic presidential candidate Howard Dean as the new chairman of the Democratic Party. At the DNC winter meeting in Washington this weekend, party leaders expressed their enthusiasm with Dean as the only hope left for a dying party. Dolores M. Bernal reports.
Howard Dean is elected chair of the Democratic National Committee.
As the last man standing for the candidacy of chairman of the Democrat Party, Howard Dean was able to claim victory on Saturday.
I'm certain that today will not mark the end of the process of selecting a DNC chair. Today will be the beginning of the reemergence of the Democratic Party.
Dean faced opposition from members within the party since he announced that he will run for the chairmanship. Groups such as the Progressive Democrats of America supported Dean's candidacy. Judy Elson is a delegate from South Dakota. As a Dean supporter, this is what she said in a video to DNC members.
I don't think we should lean towards the right to meet their issues or to confront them even. I think we need to hang on to what belongs to us.
The former Vermont governor was able to mobilize thousands of voters throughout the country when he ran for the Democrat candidacy for president last year. He emerged as an outspoken critic of President Bush's war on Iraq in a time when few Democrats in Congress opposed it. After losing control of the House, the Senate, and the White House, the Democrat leadership is hoping that Dean can turn the party around. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi of California.
I have seen Howard Dean's campaign strengths firsthand as he traveled the country for our House Democrats, organizing voters and raising money. I have seen people have stood in the rain for hours to wait to hear his message. Harry Reid and I met with Howard yesterday. We congratulated him in advance, and we look forward to working with him to win back the House and win back the Senate in 2006 and win the White House in 2008.
Among some of the things that Democrat Party members see in Dean is his proven record to raise money, use the internet to organize young adults, and his ability to attract new voters. Howard Dean.
We cannot win if all we are is against the current president and his administration. Republicans wandered around in the political wilderness for 40 years before they took back Congress. But the reason that we lost control is because we forgot why we were entrusted with that control in the first place.
Progressive Democrats, such as House Representative Sheila Jackson Lee of Texas, believe that having Dean as chairman sends a positive message to those who have given up on the Democrat Party, as well as to reach out to conservative voters.
The Democratic Party is not dead. He will be the face, if you will, of saying to the moderates, saying to Midwesterners and Southerners, that we are not going to ignore you. We want to design a Southern strategy. Governor Dean, I believe, and the new Dean members who have come into this party know how to percolate from the grassroots.
Dean has his work cut out for the next 4 years. He'll have to reshape the image of the Democrat Party, reach out to the conservatives in Middle America, the Republican moderates, and the progressive voters who are disillusioned with the Democrat Party. Dean's ideas on changing the language on issues such as abortion and gay marriage are unclear. He also talks about diversifying the party by bringing in more people of color, but has not explained his strategy. Dean's position on gun control and his NRA membership are up for scrutiny. Dolores Bernal, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
Anti-discrimination policies at law schools across the country forbid discrimination based on sexual orientation by employers engaged in on-campus recruitment. But schools are often forced to allow military recruiters on campus despite its Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. This because a federal law known as the Solomon Amendment threatens to cut federal funds to schools that ban military recruiters. Dozens of LGBT law students rallied in Northern California over the weekend to tell schools it's time to stop making exceptions for the military. Sandra Lupien has the story.
Resist intimidation! Ban discrimination! Resist intimidation!
That's the Coalition of Queer Law Student Associations, CQLSA, protesting outside San Francisco's UC Hastings College of the Law on Saturday while military recruiters talked up students inside. CQLSA said the recruiters' presence at the 21st Annual Public Interest Public Sector Legal Careers Day, or PIPS, violated the anti-discrimination policies of each of the 9 law schools participating in the event. Chelsea Haley Nelson is law president at the University of San Francisco.
Recently, there have been 2 court cases that have ruled the Solomon Amendment unconstitutional, so we believe that there's good legal standing for the schools to actually start making progress towards not inviting, not permitting the military to recruit on campus.
One of the rulings applies only to Yale Law School. The other, Fair v. Rumsfeld, was brought by a group of law schools seeking an injunction against the Solomon Amendment. In November, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals ruled in favor of the schools. But in January, the court stayed its ruling pending review by the U.S. Supreme Court. PIPS organizers declined to comment, but in a written statement, they said they supported the 2 federal rulings and opposed discrimination. But, they said, until the Third Circuit ruling was upheld, the schools could not risk breaking the law and losing significant funding by banning military recruiters. CQLSA's Haley Nelson isn't pleased with this position.
Well, I think that's somewhat of a cop-out. To date, there has not been any law school that's lost federal funding for violating the Solomon Amendment.
Earlier this month, Philadelphia area schools held their version of PIPS Day. There, too, military recruiters were allowed, though none actually showed up. That wasn't the case on Saturday at UC Hastings, where representatives from the Army, Air Force, and Marine Corps were present. U.S. Marine Corps Captain Eric Montalvo.
We're just doing what we're being told to do by people that were elected by registered voters. So I really don't have any opinion on the don't ask, don't tell policy. I follow the policy. I don't make the policy.
Some 700 law students attended the Northern California PIPS Day, and many sported rainbow stickers to show their support for LGBT students. Some, who sympathized with the protesters, like Golden Gate Law School student Jim Meyer, also saw value in having military recruiters at the event.
think about the people at Guantanamo Bay and the rigorous legal representation that they got from JAG lawyers that got them all the way to the Supreme Court. It was an important accomplishment.
To show support for LGBT students at PIPS Day, organizers distributed rainbow stickers and non-discrimination statements. CQLSA said the protest was just a small part of ongoing efforts to get military recruiters off their campuses for once and for all. LGBT student groups at the individual law schools will continue to put pressure on school administration to ban military recruiters. In San Francisco, I'm Sandra Lupien.
From his cell on Pennsylvania's death row, Free Speech Radio News correspondent Mumia Abu-Jamal brings us this commentary.
The conviction of civil rights attorney Lynn Stewart and her co-defendants, translator Mohammed Yusri and paralegal Ahmed Sattar, is a triumph of fear over reason. The three legal workers were charged and convicted of aiding and abetting terrorism in connection with their representation of the blind Egyptian sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman. When the former Attorney General Ashcroft announced the arrest of Stewart, he did so on the late-night David Letterman talk show, certainly an unprecedented venue for such an announcement. And as it began on TV, so was it often prosecuted, with a fearsome visage of Osama bin Laden beamed to jurors via videotape threatening to attack America on the sheikh's behalf. Even though the judge dutifully instructed the jury that Osama bin Laden had nothing to do with the case, how do you wash something like that from the mind after it's been admitted into evidence? Lynn's husband, activist Ralph Pointer, put the hammer to the nail when he said of the trial, quote, "This prosecution doesn't have a damn thing to do with terrorism. It has to do with politics and putting Lynn Stewart away," unquote. Stewart was really targeted because she ignored unconstitutional rules put in place by the government. In an interview with Stewart, she spoke about what the case was really about.
The Justice Department decided that things that I did as a lawyer are now to be outlawed, are now to be made into crimes in order to deter other lawyers from vigorously defending people. What I basically did was I issued a press release on behalf of my client. They said that this press release was materially aiding a terrorist organization, thus making it impossible for any First Amendment right to be protected. And to me, that is the real essence of this work, is that we be permitted to defend people such as yourself in these cases as political people, not just as defendant number 10872.
Recently, black political prisoner Albert Woodfox of the Angola 3 talked about the importance of lawyers in destroying isolation.
I think this was a pretty strong shot across the bow, as they say. You know, if you dare put forth an honest attempt to uphold the standards of law in this country, we will get you, you know. We will destroy you, because in most cases, they are our only voice to the outside world, you know.
She's taken on cases involving members of the Black Panther Party, the Attica Brothers, Puerto Rican independence fighters, and since at least 1995, the blind sheikh. But the battle isn't over. Perhaps what has happened has awakened many people in this country who would have preferred to slumber. Lynn Stewart, paralegal Ahmed Sattar, and professional translator Mohammed Yusri plan to stage a vigorous appeal of this outrageous verdict. They will need your support now more than ever. It'll take the work of many to undo John Ashcroft's revenge. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Aura Bogado.